supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. The Chinese word for busyness, I've learned, also means heart-killing. Despite all our time-saving gadgets, it seems we are busier than ever. So what's really happening to us, and what can we do to preserve our hearts and minds in this fast-paced world? Our guest today, internationally renowned psychologist Tara Brach, can help us approach the issue. She's written, "What determines our experience is the way we incline our minds." Tara Brach's an expert on Buddhist meditation and the founder and senior teacher of the Insight Meditation Community of Washington, D.C. She's the author of the bestseller Radical Acceptance, and her upcoming book is called True Refuge, Three Gateways to a Fearless Heart. Later this month, Tara's going to be here in Philadelphia conducting an evening lecture and an all-day workshop called Radical Acceptance, Healing and Freeing Our Hearts. Tara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. It's really lovely to be with you.
Oh, and you too. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too.
To our listeners, we'd love to have you join the conversation. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Tara, I don't know anyone that would disagree with the idea of slowing down and smelling the roses. I have a dear friend of mine who took a course in meditation, and now she can't find, or she thinks she can't find, 10 minutes a day to sit down and do nothing. And I doubt she's unusual.
It's true. In fact, I started realizing that one of our chronic, the traps that we have in our mind is the sense that there's not enough time. And like we move through our lives with the sense that we're on our way somewhere else and we're never going to get things done, and the squeeze of not enough time. And it makes it so that day by day, there's a sense that we don't have a chance to pause to meditate.
You know, on the other hand, I do want to say that, you know, not only is there satisfaction in accomplishment, even if it's getting through our to-do list, I mean, there's a sense of satisfaction in it, but you know, an adrenaline high feels pretty good.
It's true. I think that we kind of get addicted to, it's the same thing with anger though, we can get addicted to kind of righteousness and anger, we can get addicted to speed, we can get addicted to an adrenaline high, and there's the reason that I think a lot of people end up turning to meditation is that it's temporarily satisfying, but it seems to get in the way of what matters more, which is a sense of contact or intimacy with other people and a sense of really arriving in our lives. I think many people that end up coming to work with me say that they get the sense that they're, you know, kind of racing to the finish line, and what's the finish line? It's death, you know, it's like we're done. So There's especially as people start experiencing the big losses, which we all have, many of us have in very poignant ways, there's a recognition that it's fleeting, this life, and it's precious, and those highs that we get addicted to don't really deliver. And so we turn to something that's actually much more profoundly gratifying.
Many years ago, I did a consultation with a man and his wife, and she had stage 3 or stage 4 breast cancer, and it was clear she was dying. And he said to me, I feel like my whole life has been a dress rehearsal for this moment.
Mm.
And so he'd been living 50-some years of his life not feeling that this was his real life. That his real life was going to happen when, whatever. You know, but we're not conscious of these things.
Well, I love your example. I mean, I think that that's exactly it, that it's as if we're kind of in some story that it hasn't ended yet, and we're kind of waiting for the next moment to contain what this moment does not. And then we find out when something like that happens that we haven't been here for our life. And then that's a wake-up. That's what wake-ups are like.
Tara, our psychology, I want to talk about psychology I was going to say a bit, but that's going to be a theme running through this show. So modern psychotherapy and indeed Western medicine is founded on the disease problem. Find a problem and fix it. Freud thought all of our suffering was about deep internal conflicts, and the more we could probe these conflicts and examine them more in more depth and more detail, the more likely we were going to heal. And we thought that way for 50 years. You disagree?
Not completely. In the sense, Dan, that a lot of times that our wake-up to, whether you call it healing, our psychological healing, our spiritual awakening, starts with suffering. And the Buddha started that way, too. He basically said, look, let's be honest. We spend a lot of moments in a kind of dissatisfaction. And that's the word dukkha, or suffering, actually is meant as dissatisfaction, that everything's changing, that we can't hold on to anything, we keep trying. And so the beginning sometimes of the healing process is when we're feeling that tension or that stress. But the difference between Western psychology and, I'd say, Buddhist psychology and many of the mystical and contemplative traditions is that the end point is not to find some, just kind of ego satisfaction or just working out the problem. It's more that there's a much more full and happy and potential, that our possibility is really to realize who we are beyond any sort of a trance or story of a separate and deficient self, and to sense our connectedness with each other and this natural world. And those are things that traditional Western psychotherapy, that it wasn't moving towards.
Let's go to the phones, because I have a feeling we're going to have a lot of people that are going to want to talk to you over the course of the show. First, we've got Marie up. Marie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Can hear you well, Marie.
Good. My question or my comment was that sometimes when you have a contemplative practice or a meditative practice, I found it hard to sustain it over time because it means constantly making it a priority and constantly choosing it over perhaps other things. And so sometimes there's a tension there. I find it challenging to keep the balance.
Well, hi, Marie, and thank you for that one, because I think you're not alone. In fact, when I, even in meditation classes I teach, it's kind of the elephant in the room that, you know, everybody has a hard time maintaining a practice. What I usually suggest to people is that commit yourself, no matter what, every day to pausing. I call it the sacred pause, to pausing some for meditation. But the back door you're out is that it doesn't have to be for a long time. But I find it's really a gift to the soul to know that, just like the rhythms of all of nature, that rhythmically you're going to come home to your own experience. So there's something about that that ends up sending a message.
All right, wait a minute. Wait, let me chime in here, because in my little head, I'm hearing so many of our listeners saying, What's that mean? Come home to your own experience. So we.
I'm glad you asked it because it's the most. It's the key thing that we spend a lot of time lost in thought. We spend a lot of time on our way somewhere else. We leave our body. I mean, as you're listening right now, and I'm inviting all the listeners just to check, I mean, how aware are you in this moment of, you know, from inside out, this the aliveness of your body? And we certainly aren't listening very carefully to our hearts and, you know, to the more vulnerable or tender parts of our being. So, you know, we have to move through the day and pay attention to a whole range of experience, and that's appropriate. But it's also part of healing and being whole to have some presence right here, in the moment, in this body, in this heart. So that's, Dan, what I'm talking about, and that's why I love Marie's question, that just to have some regular practice of coming back to what's right here in the moment actually allows us to respond with a freshness and a spontaneity to our world.
So even if it's not sitting on the cushion for a half hour every morning.
Exactly. And, you know, there's a classical prototype for meditation, which has an intelligence to it, which is to come into stillness because we're so busy and so active. Our minds are moving and our bodies are moving. So to come into stillness is a support, and to sit in a way that where your body is sitting upright, not tense, but sitting tall and then relaxed, gives you a kind of posture that is conducive inwardly to being alert and relaxed.
Maria,
those are some of the basics.
Maria,
but it doesn't have to be that.
Let's bring you back, Maria. Is this helping?
Okay. It is, and I wonder about the regularity, like how important or of it being at the same time of the day, every day, that kind of consistency, do you feel is necessary?
Again, Maria, and I think it's a really important question. It's whatever works best for you. So for most people I know, it actually helps to have an anointed time, not because of rigidity, but because if left to our mood, we'll kind of postpone and then find that we didn't stay aligned with what really mattered to us. So that can be a support to have a regular time.
Maria, I want to tell you my experience with meditation, if I may. There's a couple couple of things going on. I have made a solemn commitment to do a half hour every morning, and I honor it at least six times a week, if not seven. I do it in the morning. It might not be the exact same time, but it's the half hour after I'm done breakfast. And it's become, over the years, it's what I do. I wouldn't miss breakfast, and I wouldn't miss brushing my teeth or taking a shower, and it's meditation. It's just part of my morning routine. So I wake up a half hour earlier, and I find that over the years, I find myself getting tired a half hour earlier, and I've lost nothing. I've given up nothing by having this time. The other thing I want to mention is that I've got a group I meet with every other week. A small group comes to my house once a month, and we have a larger group called Deepening Connections that's actually affiliated with the Penn Program for Mindfulness that Tara's going to speak at. So I find the support of a group very helpful. It would be very difficult to do it on my own without any support. So I hope that's helpful to you.
Yes, and, thank you.
All right, and thanks for your call. If you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Tara Brach, who's a psychologist and internationally renowned expert on the integration of Buddhist meditation and Western psychotherapy. Our number is 888-477-9499. Tara, in one of your talks, you invited your audience to reflect on the possibility that something good was going to happen in their lives. That sounds akin to cognitive therapy.
Yeah, and it actually, there is an intersection between positive psychology and meditation and Buddhist Dharma. One of the purposes of that question was this. We are very much in the habit of thinking something's wrong and that right around the corner something terrible is going to happen to us. So in a way, just to try that on, it shines a light on how much our body and system doesn't think that way. And my example was a friend of mine who is in a recovery, a cancer survivor, and one of her friends said, "Try this on," and she said, "Oh my God, I feel so strange and awkward even trying to think of it like that." So what she found was that just by exploring that idea, she saw how much she was living inside the opposite. Ultimately, we're not going to be freed up by thinking, oh, something great's going to happen or something terrible's going to happen. It's more an openness to the possibilities that are here. So it's not a training that I suggest to take on some positive affirmation and just plaster that all over your brain either.
Yeah, they don't work very well.
But no.
you know what, Tara? You know, this business of expecting something negative to happen or anticipating something wrong, I mean, that's part of our, you know, we wouldn't have survived without being in our brains. I mean, that's part of our hard wiring.
Well, it's interesting because it's true that evolution has us rigged to be pretty vigilant and nervous. We have a nervous system, you know. So when I sometimes think of it as, you know, that the lower brains, the brain stem and the limbic system, are really rigged for fight, flight, and freeze. And our brains are usually kind of the fear centers kind of drive fearful thoughts. And that's certainly part of what we needed. Humans needed that to survive. And we also have a social brain, you know, mirror neurons that allow us to perceive our connections with each other and to give and receive care. And we also have part of our brain that is metacognition, which means that we can see all that fight, flight thinking and behavior, and yet realize that we have some choice, that doesn't encompass the whole of our experience of what we are. And so I think of it as an evolution of consciousness.
Yes.
That, yes, we need to be able, we need our ego self to navigate, and that's not the end of the story. We're more than that ego self, and our brain is actually designed to help us perceive that our identity is not limited. I sometimes, Dan, think of it as a spacesuit self, that we enter a difficult environment and we put on this spacesuit to navigate, but we forget who's looking through the mask. You know, we forget that awareness and that love that's really essence. So part of this, the reason we meditate, and it's just a tool to help us recognize, okay, this is ego activity, and it's, some of it's necessary and useful, and some of it's absolutely harmful, and find out who we are beyond that ego self. So we have more choice.
I said I think it was the billboard for today's show. I said, you know, when we have a problem, a Buddhist might say, "Do nothing." And, you know, the engineer at the time said, "Well, what's the good of that?" And I said to him, "Well, they wouldn't say do nothing permanently, but they might say when you have a problem, the first thing to do is do nothing. See what happens with the problem. See what happens with your reactivity to the problem, with the emotions associated with the problem. Just see what happens for a few minutes." And you know, I heard someone quoted a neuroscientist who said, "We once thought that we were thinking beings who feel, and the truth of the matter is, we are feeling beings who think." That's in the ideal. We are able to think and not simply be reactive to our feelings. And that's where doing nothing really helps solve problems.
I think that's a great description. One of my favorite understandings, and Viktor Frankl put it, I think, the best. He said, between the stimulus and the response, there is a space. And in that space is your power and your freedom.
Yeah, yeah.
And I call it the sacred pause. It's the same thing. We're not doing nothing forever. I mean, that's not the point. We're meant to be active. It's part of our... It's the wonder of expression, you know. And if we want to have our activity emerge from the most wise and compassionate place in us, then we need to have this capacity to pause. And as you said, to just be with and contact what's here so that we really are coming from the depth of who we are.
All right. Well, listen, young lady, I've been hugging you. Our lines are filled up with people who are yearning for a piece of your wisdom, and we've gone way late on taking our break. So this is what you've done to me.
Lovely.
All right. So we'll be back in just 1 minute. My guest is Tara Brach. She's a psychologist and expert on the integration of Buddhist meditation and Western psychology. She's a senior teacher of the Insight Meditation Community of Washington, D.C. Later this month, the weekend of May 21st, she'll be conducting an evening lecture and day-long workshop called Radical Acceptance, Healing and Freeing Our Hearts. For more information, go to stress.management@uphs.penn.edu, or you can simply look up the Penn program for mindfulness. Well, like I said, we'll be back in 60 short seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is committed to making lives better every day. They've developed a partnership with the University of Pennsylvania for Cancer Treatment, Radiology, and Radiation Oncology. Details at chestercountyhospital.org.
6 p.m. on WHYY-FM.
I'm Dave Heller, host of WHYY's NewsWorks Tonight.
Your local news.
At City Hall, I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Special reports.
For the Health and Science Desk, I'm Tanya English.
The trusted journalism you expect from WHYY-FM. NewsWorks Tonight, a half hour of local news and features, premiering May 16th at 6 p.m. on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, featuring a luxury hybrid that gets an estimated 41 miles per gallon in the city, a crossover that uses voice and touch commands, and a sedan featuring available active park assist technology. Lincoln, it's not just luxury, it's smarter than that.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. My guest is Tara Brach, internationally known psychologist and Buddhist meditator. She's known for her book, Radical Acceptance. She's going to be here with the Penn Program for Mindfulness the weekend of May 21st. Tara, like I said before the... Before a break, we've got lots of callers who want to join the conversation. And by the way, our number is 888-477-9499. So, okay, if we get to the phone lines?
Oh, please, yeah.
Let's start with Leah. Leah, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a little nervous. I wanted to ask you, I've been in, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah.
I've been in therapy, Western therapy, for on and off for years, and I had childhood issues of being hurt and trust, and suffered with an eating disorder through high school, and I'm 40 years old now, and I'm trying to figure out patterns that I have in my relationship, and what your best advice in beginning of forgiveness of things from my childhood and forgiveness of my partner who's as unperfect as I am, and we've hurt each other in our past, and I just am having a hard time, I guess, with my ego, and focusing on somehow renewal and getting over past parts of trust issues. And I'll just leave it at that. I know it's probably a loaded question, but
Leigh, you know what? It's a great question, and it's a very human issue that you struggle with, this business of forgiving our past or letting go of injuries from our past. But I would like to turn that in a slightly different direction and turn before I turn it over to you, Tar. And that's, you know, we did a show a couple of months ago, I think, on the issue of self-compassion before you do anything else. Compassion for self, yes? You there, Tara?
Yes, I'm here, yeah. I actually, my mind is going just to the same place, that it's the starting place. We can't forgive anyone else until we start holding ourselves with kindness. And in a very simple way, there's a few steps, Leah, that feel really important. And one is, there's something called the second arrow, and the first arrow is the pain we feel, and the second arrow is in some way saying, it's my fault, I'm bad. And if there's a way that you can sense, it's not my fault, you know, I would be different if I could be. I didn't want it this way, I didn't choose it this way. So in some way, to say it's not my fault, and then just to sense into yourself, to any place where you're most feeling hurt, sad, afraid, shame, and then just to send a message to yourself of care. That is the beginning of profound change. And I find that self-compassion, and I'll go right to the gist of it, people that can put their hand on their own heart in some way, whether it's physically or energetically, and sense what is it that my heart most needs to hear. And this is moment to moment, just sensing, you know, is what's the need right now? And to send a message to yourself, the more moments you do that, the more you start changing, actually, the neural pathways in your brain that keep the injury in place. So I'll start with that, and Dan, I'd love to hear your sense, too, as just a kind of a strategy, a meditative strategy with yourself to begin the healing.
Yeah, I would encourage Leah, you know, my hunch is, you know, people with tender hearts like yours and mine and Tara's, you know, we're really good at finding compassion for others who suffer. Yes, Leah?
Yes. Yes, very much.
Yeah, it's easy.
I feel that that's part of who I am.
Yeah.
And that's why I get so frustrated with the other part, in that I feel like just analyzing and reanalyzing
Slow down.
Can you hear me?
Slow down, honey. You're going too fast into the habitual stuff. So you're able to open that tender heart to others when they suffer.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I am.
So here's where I want you to go. The next time you open your tender heart, simply be aware of what that experience is like. Before you do anything or say anything, just notice the feeling in your chest. Okay. In your chest, notice that feeling. And then the next time you suffer, notice that feeling and find that compassion for this kind woman named Leah with a tender heart who's suffering just at this moment. And if it moves you, if it moves you to tears, then you're on the right track. But it's got to start with compassion, and compassion alone can have a ripple effect beyond what any of us can imagine. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. Thanks so much for your call.
Take good care.
You have said that we have forgotten who we are. I'm inclined to agree, but tell me what you mean by that.
Sure. We tend to get very hooked on a sense of a self that is trying to get somewhere and prove something and defend something. And in that, we forget the tenderness that you were just talking about. And more than that, we forget the awareness that's right here. So there's a wholeness of being, and I sometimes use the metaphor kind of ocean and waves. We get hooked on the waves, the temporary passing experiences, and forget that oceanness. That's the broad response, and there, you know, we might want to go into more of the particulars.
Well, I do. Let's talk about, you know, and so what we're doing then in that process is we push away parts of our experience.
That's right. It's what the parts of our, in the way I think of it, sometimes, you know, there's Carl Jung said that nothing has a stronger influence psychologically on their environment, especially on their children, than the unlived life of the parents. And so I think of it as unlived life, that we move through the day and there's tenderness and vulnerability and emotions and sensitivity, loneliness, that we just continuously push away. It's like we're walling it away. And so we get identified with the very things we're pushing away. We get identified with our fears and with our cravings and lose track of a wholeness of being. So the way back to wholeness is really to process or digest or touch into what we're pushing away.
So,
and that's the whole process of meditation, is to open to what's here, to what we kind of habitually run away from.
On the other hand, experiencing our lives on certain given moments would overwhelm us. And I'm thinking about people, I'm thinking about myself, when I've experienced trauma as a child, at the hands of my seventh grade teacher when I was molested. I didn't feel anything then. And that's adaptive. And that's adaptive to a certain extent for anybody who's experienced trauma in the moment they're experiencing. Yes?
Yeah. And it's absolutely true. There's not some principle that says that at any time in your life you're supposed to open to the entire experience and feel it. There's a wisdom and a compassion to experiencing what we have the capacity to experience. And so I sometimes, when I'm working with people that have been traumatized, if the basic principle is there's unlived life and we need to be able to experience it to be whole, the next principle is, what is it going to take to have it so that we're resilient enough and strong enough and safe enough to be able to touch that?
Mm.
And so when working with trauma, we can spend a really important period of time cultivating a kind of inner resourcefulness. And by that I mean giving us access to a feeling of where love is and where safety is. And we have to really, and that might mean that for somebody, let's say one woman I'm working with who was sexually abused by her uncle and then by boyfriends, she had to take about 8 months when we worked together of calling on her allies, which were, you know, she had two, her sister and a friend and myself, that she would bring to mind and imagine surrounding her. And surrounding her, and really that she was bathed in a sense of our care and surrounded by us and very safe. And it wasn't until she could feel loved, feel safe, that we could then begin to have her tap into the experience that she had been running from, which was a sense of being violated. And the basic understanding is that if you bring added resources to a situation and then relive it in some way, it gets transformed.
And
but if you go back to an old trauma and there's not an added resource, in other words, there's not enough mindfulness or compassion, you actually re-traumatize. You deepen the pathways.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Brian on the line.
Sure.
Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Welcome.
Hi, Brian.
How you doing?
So far, so good. How about you?
Pretty good. Great hour, half hour so far. I'll just jump right into the question, if that's cool with you guys.
Yeah.
Please.
All right. I have been, I would say, an amateur as far as practicing mindfulness goes for years now. I've been extremely interested since I was introduced in high school. And I just have such a hard time in, you know, as far as the daily American, lifestyle goes, just work situation and just, you know, stress, more stress. It's just really hard for me sometimes to just settle down and completely be 100% mindful of what I'm doing at every moment.
Well, go on.
And basically, just very generally or very simply, I wanted to know if you had any recommendations as far as just simple practices that can make these things a lot, you know, make it a lot easier for me. It's really hard to block out, you know, the debt and this and that and so on and so forth and relationships and everything, you know.
Yeah, I don't think Tara is going to give you tips to blocking that stuff out.
They're not blocking out. I just to be mindful of, you know, what I'm doing, and then in the books I've read, you know, there's just small things like washing the dishes and just being aware of just you're just solely washing the dishes. Do you follow me?
Are you able to do that, Brian? With the dishes?
That's the example that I read, and I try to, you know, but it's just something, you know, anything. Start to creep in, and I just wanted to know if there's any small practices.
Let's hear from Tara.
Well, I love your question because, you know, I think sometimes it's like an unfair setup to say, you know, mindful 24/7, and it feels stressful, and mindfulness has actually got a very relaxed quality. So you might want to say, in any given moment, is it possible just to relax a little more and just notice what's happening? You know, without making it this, you know, turning it into some tense task. But I'll give you a few of the things that I have found in my life bring more moments into that kind of presence. And one of them is intention. You know, that the Buddha said that our entire life arises out of the tip of intention. And to the extent that right now, Brian, you and Dan and I have an intention right in this moment to be open-hearted and are kind, to the extent we're sincere about that, it's like that is what will come out of the next moment. So you might just, even at the beginning of a day, just have an aspiration. You know, may I be present for this day as much as possible? And you might even, in your mind, think of a few areas of the day that it's really important to you that you kind of be as attuned as possible. Do you know what I mean? The areas that matter to you, like it may be in a certain conversation or a certain part of work, or and so you just set your intention. So that's one very specific thing.
So
having intention,
Tara. So all of that takes about 30 seconds before you get out of bed.
Yep, it's in the morning. And at any point during the day, you can remember. There's one of my teachers says the most important thing is remembering the most important thing. You know, like the more we can align the compass of our heart, you know. So to any extent, like even right now when you get off this call, you know, just what matters? What really matters to me? And for most of us, we find ultimately, what matters is that we're connected with other people or that we're kind or that we are creative or whatever. But just to remember actually brings us into that state of mind more. Mm-hmm. So that's one piece. A couple of other things that help a lot. One is to pause, like little pauses. Like when I say pause, I mean 10 seconds. But you might park your car, and then before you get out of the car, just pause for a few seconds so that in that pause, again, there's an arriving that'll help you to be more there for whatever's next. So pausing between things, and then use your body as an anchor. Like even right now, if you can, you know, kind of feel your breath and come back into your body, feel your hands from the inside, feel how there might be, if you soften them, there might be some tingling there. You know, just know that you're in your body. And again, that helps to bring alive a kind of mindfulness and more energy and clarity into the moment. So those are just a few things that I found are helpful.
Oh, that's great. And Brian, thanks so much for your call.
Thanks, Brian.
We've got to take a short break, Tara. We'll be back in just 1 minute, and I want to talk to you about your life and how that's going.
All right, thanks.
I can't not do that. You know, I tried, but I can't.
It.
Good. My guest is Tara Brach, and she's internationally renowned psychologist who's one of the best around at integrating Eastern thinking into Western psychology. She's senior teacher at the Insight Meditation Community of Washington, D.C. Of course, she's the author of best-selling book Radical Acceptance. And later this month, weekend of May 21st, she'll be conducting an evening lecture and day-long workshop called Radical Acceptance, Healing and Freeing Our Hearts. It's with the Penn Program for Mindfulness, and you'll find that on there. You'll find that on their webpage. Well, we'll be back in just 60 seconds. If you want to join the conversation, we're at 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
On the next Fresh Air, the rise of Hitler through the eyes of an American ambassador. Eric Larson's new book is about William Dodd, who went to Germany in 1933. At Dodd's second meeting with Hitler,
Hitler explodes and he says, you know, that all the criticism of Germany is coming from and inspired by Jews, and that he, if it continues, he's going to make an end to them.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Wilbert Rideau served 44 years in prison for murder, but prison is where Rideau found his voice and became an award-winning journalist helping to expose the epidemic of sexual violence in prisons.
This was seen as accepted macho behavior, and the story caused everybody to see it in a different light.
My conversation with award-winning journalist Wilbert Rideau. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. I'm with Tara Brach, author of Radical Acceptance. And she's probably known internationally as one of the leading experts on integrating Buddhist thinking with Western psychology. She's the senior teacher and founder at the Insight Meditation Community at Washington, D.C., and she'll be here the weekend of May 21st. I'll tell you more about that later. Tara, I want to talk about finding meaning in our lives. You said that serving others gives our lives meaning.
That's one of the things. When you say the word meaning, what do you mean?
Well, you know, everyone that I know of kind of feels better when they have a sense of meaning in their lives, what their lives are about, where they fit in the world, where they contribute, and how.
Yeah. So the word I'm taking that word where we fit, because as I reflect on meaning for most of us ends up having some sense of a larger belonging, that we sense how our life belongs to something larger, belongs to other people, belongs to the whole web of aliveness, belongs to spirit, whatever way we conceive it, there's belonging. And so then the inquiry is really, you know, what allows us to sense a larger belonging, that meaning? And service is certainly one thing. When we're serving, and I don't mean service in any sort of a mechanical way, but where there's that real sincere sense of wanting to help, it's not as if we're helping an other out there. It becomes really helping all of us. And that feels like an important distinction, because that's what gives a sense of belonging.
One of the most powerful things I learned about that, I think if it weren't for serving, I might not be alive today. Right after my accident 30 years ago, when I became a quadriplegic, you know, my self-esteem was You can imagine how low it was. I felt like I was worthless and unlovable. And people told me I still had value, but I just thought they were saying that to keep me alive. And one night I was in ICU, and a nurse came up to me and said, "You're a psychologist, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And she asked if she could talk to me, and she told me about all the pain in her life, and there was some significant losses, and she was suicidal. And because I knew that suffering, I felt her inside of me like I've never felt anyone before. And she knew that she was felt. She knew that she was understood. So I made a referral after that. And after she left, I closed my eyes and I said, "I can live with this." It was my ability to help her, my knowledge that I could help another human being, helped me understand where I fit in our species as a human, that I was able to reclaim my place as a human again. She saved my life by asking something of me.
Oh, that's a fantastic story, and I completely get it, Dan. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I feel like that says it all, that when we realize, it's like you realized who you were beyond some suffering victim.
Right, right.
You realized a larger sense of your being, and one larger sense of our being is that we can serve. Another is savoring, that we can feel, take in the mystery and the beauty that's here.
Right.
And there's meaning in that. And I feel like we, again, in our fast-paced world, we don't pause enough to savor. There's meaning in feeling loved. It's, we think of it as the value is being a loving person. I find that sometimes the most profound healing and awakening comes in the moments of actually taking it in, that can we actually breathe in or feel the love in this world that includes us. So there's different ways towards meaning. Those are some of them.
Yeah, when you talk about that, when we can experience that, the emotion I would label is called awe, A-W-E.
Yes. Yes, the awe, wonder. It's right. Just an amazing mystery. It's,
right.
You know, they say life is not a problem to be solved, but a mystery to be lived. And when we stop thinking and figuring things out so much, we get that it's just this amazing mystery.
I want to get to know you a bit as promised. So you grew up locally here in Montclair, New Jersey, and you started off as a majoring in political science, your undergraduate degree was that. And then you spent the next 10 years in ashrams, which is typical for political scientists. Isn't that what they all do?
Well, and I still feel like a social activist. I mean, I feel like the worlds aren't that separate. You started off our talking about non-doing. And I think when we quiet and pause, we then see the world around us as we really want to contribute. We want to, move towards what is healing change. So I still am an activist.
But, exactly.
But that said, it in college, I majored in both political science and psychology. So it's the inner and the outer.
You alluded when we spoke to you about some health problems.
Yeah. In the last 8 years, I've decreasing mobility because of some connective tissue disorder that I have, and it's been one of the major places of waking up for me, Dan. And it doesn't have in any way the drama or suddenness of the loss you went through, but for me, a huge amount of grief and loss on this one because I've been very much an athlete and so on, and. And it's forced me, it's the reason I wrote True Refuge, or that I'm almost finished writing True Refuge, is that William James said that every religion starts with the cry, help. That we all, whether we've just had a sudden loss like of our health or somebody we love, that there's something in us that knows that that's just part of living, is this kind of loss. And for me, the big inquiry was, okay, if I can't do the things I love doing, how am I going to find, as you described it, meaning? How am I going to feel that full aliveness? And for me, it became increasingly clear that if I could remember love, if I could remember feeling loved and loving, and that kind of belonging, and for me it happens a lot with nature and also in moments now we're talking, the sense of hearts being here and sensing the listeners and sensing we're all part of this together. In those moments, there's a kind of meaning that makes it so that my heart is big enough for the losses of what's going on in my body. That's a very quick summary that's somewhat parallel to what you described, but my own version of how to make peace with even the biggest losses.
Yeah, my experience with my patients, with myself, is that peace doesn't come when we've won battles. Peace comes when we stop fighting.
Exactly, and it takes practice because it's not a one shot. We stop fighting and then we start again.
Yeah.
I've had many, many rounds of, you know, feeling victimized or self-pity or fear, and over again, I have to, as one teacher described it, meet my edge and then soften. And
listen,
there's two questions that really help, and one is, what's happening right now? And the other is, can I be with this with kindness?
Let me, we are completely out of time, and I just want to say one thing to you. You know, you've been talking about love and open heart, and that's all a bunch of talk. When I see you in a few weeks, I want a hug.
You've got it, honey.
All right.
You've got it.
It's a deal. Thanks so much for joining us. You were wonderful.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, listeners.
Tara Brach is a psychologist, internationally renowned expert on meditation and psychotherapy. And she will be here later this month, the weekend of May 21st. She'll be conducting an evening lecture in a day-long workshop called Radical Acceptance, Healing and Freeing Our Hearts. For more information, go to the Penn Program for Mindfulness webpage. Well, if you got any questions or comments, we're at voices@whyy.org. And you can find me at drdangottlieb.com. And, of course, we are a podcast, and you can get that from our webpage, whyy.org. Well, the engineers for the show's been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer for audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Emily Haas is our intern. And I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.